Actually, fuck that.
All right, all you movie junkies. It is time for the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim.
And welcome one and all to episode 72 of the SLS Cast. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, it's the Chicago Bulls episode of the SLS Cast. And you're sitting there thinking to yourself, hang on a second, what the fuck does the Chicago Bulls have anything to do with movies? Well, in fact, they really don't have anything to do with movies per se, but they do have everything to do with the number 72. It turns out that the Chicago Bulls achieved no less than 72 victories during the 1995-96 NBA season, which is the National Basketball Association record for games won by a team. And with that sports trivia knowledge, I, of course, am your recovering alcoholic pot-addicted host, Matt.
Matt, you cannot be addicted to pot.
Well, I can be a recovering alcoholic. Failing recovering alcoholic, as it were, because I am, like, way the fuck drunk right now. So we're going to have a really good show, I promise.
What was your drink of choice? What is your singing? What lubricates your vocals?
The vocals this evening were, it was actually a Starbuck, I believe it was. And it was just a draft beer that they said they had on tap. I was like, well, I'll give it a shot. And they had the normal version and then an IPA version. And I'm not a big fan of IPA because it's a little too hoppy for me. And I went with the regular version and it was fucking fantastic, dude. Fantastic. So I used that to lubricate my vocal cords. We are on the 22nd of April, 2012. And I participated in a karaoke contest that I did actually make it to the semifinals of. And I'm competing for $500, so I'm pretty excited about that. And, yeah, so that's what I was drinking, and I'm feeling really good right now. Now, in a couple of hours, I imagine the buzz is going to wear off, and then I'm probably going to get a bit of a headache, and then I'm not going to feel so hot, but that's going to be after the show.
And my name is Tim, and I am drinking water.
For like the first time in like 15 episodes, you're drinking water. How many episodes have we started with the pop the top of the can? I mean,
I
come on now.
I think four.
Just four, really?
Yeah.
Wow, that's almost disappointing.
The illusion is gone. This is the magic of podcasting.
That's right. The beauty of the 420 episode is now destroyed. So I understand, though, that we have some fun kind of pre-news news. So what have you got for us, sir? Lay it on us.
Okay, mine pertains to Liam Neeson, Woody Allen, and sex, which is pretty interesting. And I've been wanting to talk about this for, I guess, a month or so now. And this story, this report, came from the Hollywood Reporter. And it's based on an article from GQ, and they interviewed Liam Neeson. This came out, I guess, late March, almost a month ago. There you go. And so it kind of came about as from the Woody Allen controversy that spawned a couple months ago. And this is what it says. This is pretty interesting. So Liam Neeson was in a Woody Allen movie back in 1992 called Husbands and Wives. And he had to perform a sex scene with Judy Davis. And at that time, during the sex scene, is when he learned that Mia Farrow apparently found the naked photos of their daughter and Woody Allen. Previn, I think the Previn is the name. And it was their adopted daughter. I'm saying I should be drinking beer because I cannot pronounce anything. Their adopted daughter, Previn. Previn. This is what he had to say. Quote, "There's a scene where I'm going down on Judy Davis, right? Judy and I are in bed, obviously covered up, and as I'm going down, Judy's having this monologue in her head, and the crew are all ready and we're waiting for Woody. No show. It's starting to get a bit uncomfortable. It's a bed scene. Anyway, he came out after about 20 minutes and said, okay, camera starts on Judy. Liam, I just want to see the top of your head. Okay, we know where you're going, so there was no apology. Nothing. End quote. Talk about a very awkward time in your acting career, I guess. I mean, I doubt anything can really top that in his career. Because you're performing a sex scene in a movie where it just came out that your director is a pedophile and drugged and raped their pretty much child. So, yeah. It kind of lost its luster, I think, over the past month. But I just thought it was interesting. Just wanted to throw it out there and let it be known that this article exists.
Well, it is definitely news of the weird. And I think I can actually add to that in the news of the weird category. I actually have two news of the weird for you. So I'm going to go with the darker of the two, since you kind of went on that precipice, as it were. A few days ago, and by a few, I mean five, there was some poor bastard by the name of Andre Johnson. And this, and you might not have heard of Andre Johnson, but he does go by the name of Christ Bearer. And he was with a rap group called North Star. Wu-Tang Fan? What the hell is the matter with me? Oh, I know what's the matter with me. Wu-Tang Clan founding member RZA produced North Star's debut album. So those in the rap world perhaps have heard of this man. This poor bastard cut off his penis and jumped from a second floor balcony in an apparent suicide attempt. The problem was he didn't quite succeed. Oh, the sad part was while he did not succeed in killing himself, he did succeed in cutting off his penis in such a way that they could not reattach it. Apparently, members of North Star told TMZ that they were there when Johnson, without warning, cut off his penis and leaped. They said by the time they got downstairs, he was running around screaming. They also said hard drugs were not involved and believe Johnson must have mental problems. I'm just going to leave that one there. I'm going to leave that one there. That is courtesy of FoxNews.com. And we're just going to leave it at that. Now, the other news of the weird that I have is there's a guy out there, and I swear to God, I think that this would have been perfect for last week. Unfortunately, the article didn't come out until yesterday. So, I mean, there's just no way I can do it. This comes to us from Vice.com. It's courtesy of Georgia Perry. There's a guy out there, and he's trying to collect every single copy of the movie Speed on VHS. He owns over 500 copies currently, and he also owns 26 laser discs of the film. But see, he uses those to barter for more VHS copies. This is a dude who also has bought a van that he is currently refurbing to be a replica of the bus from Speed.
It's a van.
I know.
He will not succeed.
I know, but the thing is that the interior is remarkably similar already. He's doing pretty good. He's got a Kickstarter going, and it started off as a Christmas joke. He was at a pawn shop. He didn't have a whole lot of cash for his family for Christmas, and he was at a pawn shop, found six copies of Speed, and was like, oh, I know what I'll do. I'll just give everybody as kind of a cross gag gift / I love everybody the same kind of gift, going to give all of his family a copy of Speed. So he goes and he looks at the six copies of Speed, and then he saw that they had 11, and he's like, man, I wonder if it was actually possible, if it would actually be possible to buy as many copies of VHS of Speed as there was. So he buys all 11 copies that the pawn shop has, and he said he got them for 11 cents a copy. And that's what started the obsession. So now he's trying to get every VHS copy. He has over 500, as I said before. And this guy sounds like a complete stoner. It's a hilarious article. I highly, highly recommend that you read it. Vice.com came out yesterday, April 21st. And it's by Georgia Perry. And again, this guy, this is the actual title. This guy is trying to collect every single copy of the movie Speed on VHS, which he admits is not exactly feasible because there's no way to know if he's ever going to get every available copy.
And that's he does know that the movie Speed does not have the same effects as taking Speed.
I'm honestly not sure he has made that connection. But that's my news of the weird. I just thought, you know, that it was fun to talk about that. And especially because, you know, you had some fun news of the weird. But I guess unless there's anything else, should we just drop right into the regular stuff?
Yes, the real news.
It is time for the news. The news. All right, so do you want to go first or do you want me to go first? Because I've got like a whole three things because it was such a productive week for me that I have actually no real
I can talk. I can do be a little chatty Kathy for the beginning here.
Outstanding. Then go with it, chatty Timothy.
Okay, first off is updated Star Wars news, and it turns out that a lot of people, I mean, I'm assuming a lot of people, Matt, you tell me if you're one of them, they were hoping, or they are hoping, that the new Star Wars movies will expand into the expanded universe, because there are, I mean, hundreds of books, there are video games, there are cartoons, and all of those kind of took these characters, went off on side characters, and created so much more backstory that a lot of people are very familiar with and absolutely enjoy. I mean, Matt, are you one of those folk?
I am a passive appreciator of the expanded universe. I know that it exists. I understand that there have been a great many wonderful stories told in said expanded universe, including one in which Chewbacca is killed. But I have never been one to fully partake in said universe. The closest I came to it was a fan fiction crossover of Star Trek Next Generation and Star Wars. But I am aware of the world in which you are referring.
Well, according to this Hollywood Reporter article here, Kinberg was interviewed by IGN. He's the one who's writing one of the trilogy, the non-trilogy products. He was asked if I probably should say his first name, Simon Kinberg, there we go, Simon Kinberg, asked if the new movies would look into the expanded universe of Star Wars comic books, movies, and various video games for inspiration. And Kinberg said that, quote, you know, it's not off limits, and it's certainly inspiring. I'm working on an animated show for Lucasfilm as well, Star Wars Rebels. That will take inspiration from everywhere. But I know for the movies, the canon is the canon, and the canon is the six films that exist, end quote. And those six films include the original trilogy as well as the prequel trilogy. So that is kind of sort of confirmation right there that the new films will not expand into the expanded or go into the expanded universe. However, the other movies that are coming out, if they do delve into the expanded universe, will that then make them not a part of the new Star Wars, Han and Leia movies or whatever? I don't know. But we will find out soon. December 2015.
Right on, right on. Okay, well then, my first up comes from NOLA.com, which is a New Orleans newspaper. This is courtesy of Mike Scott. Turns out, ladies and gentlemen, that Terminator Genesis began shooting yesterday in New Orleans. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Arnold Schwarzenegger is back. Terminator Genesis. The filth film. The filth film? That's terrible. That's too much beer. I'm sorry. Terminator Genesis, the fifth film in the popular sci-fi action franchise, and the one that comes on the heels of 2009's Terminator Salvation, the only film in the series that didn't star Schwarzenegger, although featured a cameo, if you will, of him, began principal photography yesterday in New Orleans. Quote, "I was upset that I couldn't be in the fourth Terminator because I was governor of California," Schwarzenegger recently told MTV about the prospect of returning to the role that helped make him a household name. Quote, "So they did the fourth one without me. It made me cry a little bit, but I did say, I'll be back. So now I'm back again, and it's going to be really terrific," end quote. Turns out that the film is being directed by Thor: The Dark World director Alan Taylor. So I'm holding out hope for that. That was not a terrible sequel as far as sequels go. It's got Emilia Clarke from Game of Thrones as Sarah Connor, and Jason Clarke from Zero Dark Thirty as John Connor, and Jai Courtney from A Good Day to Die Hard as Kyle Reese. They are also joined in the cast by Byung-Hun Lee from G.I. Joe Retaliation, J.K. Simmons from Juno, Sadreen Holt from House of Cards, and Sadreen Holt, thank you, from House of Cards, and Dayo Okenyi from The Hunger Games. Paramount's keeping the plot far under wraps. The only thing that Arnold has gone on record as saying is, quote, "Terminator deals with a lot of time travel, so there will be a younger T-800, and then when that model, what that model does later on when it gets reprogrammed and who gets hold of him, so it will be all kinds of interesting twists in the movie, but I feel so good," end quote. I am thoroughly excited about this. This is probably going to tie into what we're going to be doing next week for our bonus segment of I'm the Only One Who Liked It. I did like 2009's Terminator Salvation. I thought it was a good movie. Nobody apparently agrees with me, and that's okay. I'm probably just going to talk about that next week. So I'm really excited to see how they tie this into the universe, and I'm really excited. What about you, sir? Are you at all glad this is happening?
I can take it or leave it, to be honest. Because I was so upset with Terminator Salvation that I don't know what to expect. So,
well, I mean, I guess then you're not going to be able to have an I'm the Only One Who Hated It segment. Because, you know, well, it wouldn't matter because you're not the only one who hated it. All right, what do you got, sir? What do you got?
Okay, so Joss Whedon, a new Whedon production was just previewed this past Sunday night at the Tribeca Film Festival. It is entitled In Your Eyes. It's an indie film. I believe he wrote it and produced it. He didn't direct it. Currently he is doing the Avengers 2 Age of Ultron, and I'm pretty sure Marvel has had him by the balls as of the past year or two. However, during the premiere, he had a little post-screening message for the audience, and this is what he had to say.
Hi, it's Joss. I wanted to welcome everybody. I wish I could be there with you, but I'm here with me instead. I did want to say thank you for coming to the film. It's a very exciting night for us because it's not just the premiere of the film, it is the worldwide release date, because as of now, In Your Eyes is available on any internet-capable device at inyoureyesmovie.com for the sturdy price of $5. This is exciting for us because it means we get to explore yet another new form of distribution, and we get $5. So I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you enjoy the Q&A, and thanks.
So that's kind of interesting, and apparently that kind of changes the game, the movie game, a little bit, because Whedon is a popular guy. His movie, The Avengers 2, is the third highest grossing movie of all time. Yes, he didn't direct this movie. It's directed by Brian Hill. However, I am sure, even with Whedon's Much Ado About Nothing, if he came out with that currently, he probably would have released for $5 on the Vimeo website. One of the reasons why is because not only is Bryn Hill not really a well-known director, they would lose a ton of money through marketing and promotion and putting the movie in theaters. Because not a lot of people are going to watch the movie, or are not going to go and see the movie in the theater, not because they're not interested in seeing the movie, but because possibly their local theater will not be carrying the movie. In the Woodlands, close to Matt, there's a place called Market Street, owned by Cinemark. It's like a 5 or 6 theater, 6 screen theater. I used to go there a lot, and that place, other than in downtown Houston, that was one of the only places that would really show a lot of the foreign movies, a lot of the low-budget indie films, and movies like that.
Amen.
So this is interesting. Amen. This really expands the, you know, makes the movie available for anybody to watch it at their own leisure. And I'm just guessing maybe the 72-hour rental thing is only for, like, a test, seeing how many people will take advantage of it and scope it out or not scope it out to see if it's worth it. But I think with these independent movies, it is worth it. What do you think, Matt?
I agree. And that's why I said amen, amen earlier, because it was nice to have something on the north side of town. For those of you not familiar with the geography of Houston, Houston is a really cool city, very metropolitan, but it has really more or less kind of 3 downtowns. It's got a downtown proper, where you have the downtown of Houston, you've got Minute Maid Park, you've got George R. Brown, Toyota Center, all that kind of stuff. Then you also have the Galleria, which is its own kind of downtown, if you will. And then it also has the Medical Center, which is also kind of a sub-downtown, so to speak. And therefore, when you're trying to get to areas, if you live in the suburbs, it's very difficult to get to things that are like kind of crossover areas like Montrose, where you have a lot of really interesting theaters, a lot of really cool food, a lot of all that kind of stuff. So it was such a godsend when the Woodlands got Market Street, because that was when we got our theater that's much like what we used to, like Tim and I, when we went and saw Zombie down at the River Oaks. What was that? Was that a year ago or 2 years ago?
That was October 2011.
There
so
you go.
So two and a half years
ago. So I mean, I've seen some great Miyazaki films over there. They get lots of the lower budget films, lots of the anime flicks, lots of the independent movies and stuff. And so that's where we go here in the north part of Houston. And so I cannot agree more. I'm hoping that the Vimeo aspect is, like you said, I'm hoping it's more of a test, because then even if you did not get a chance to partake, you'll still be able to go to your local theater, like your River Oaks or your Market Street, and you'll be able to go and enjoy anything like, even if you're not necessarily into Bryan Singer per se, you know, at least maybe this will draw more attention to those theaters so that you'll make sure to frequent them more often.
Indeed.
And since we are on the subject of Bryan Singer, I guess I will go ahead and do my Bryan Singer news, which is not quite as glowing, unfortunately, but let's hope.
Bryan Singer.
I'm sorry?
I didn't mention Bryan Singer.
I thought you said Bryan Singer's movie.
No.
Who the fuck's movie was it?
Joss Whedon's.
Oh my god. What the shit am I thinking of that it was Bryan? Oh, have some more beer, Matt. Oh my fucking god,
Matt,
I'm so sorry.
You're drunk. I'm cutting you off.
You should. I can't believe that I can. Can you blame me though? Can you blame me for one? For two different Marvel movie directors that I got them confused? My bad. I apologize. All right, but coming to us from Variety.com, courtesy of Ted Johnson, X-Men director Bryan Singer. See? Marvel. It's all fucking Marvel. X-Men director Bryan Singer accused of sexually abusing teenage boy. Turns out that X-Men Days of Future Past director Bryan Singer has been accused of sexually abusing a teenage boy in 1999 in a lawsuit filed last Wednesday. Now, this, of course, is about a week old, so it's about 2 weeks old by now. In Hawaii, of all places, in a Hawaii federal court. Turns out the plaintiff, Michael Egan, claims he was 15 years old when Singer forcibly sodomized him, among other allegations. Egan's lawyers, led by Jeff Herman, alleged that Singer provided him with drugs and alcohol and flew him to Hawaii on more than one occasion in 1999. His suit claims battery, assault, intentional infliction of emotional distress, and invasion of privacy by unreasonable intrusion, and it seeks unspecified damages. Singer's attorney, Marty Singer, and I didn't misread that. Singer's attorney, Marty Singer, called the lawsuit absurd and defamatory. Quote, end quote. Quote, the claims made against Bryan Singer are completely without merit. We are very confident that Bryan will be vindicated, end quote. Okay, This is a really interesting article in terms of the scope of the actual article itself. It does not just limit him. It's basically saying that he was part of kind of a club that brought unwitting kids into the fold and said, hey, we'll give you modeling jobs and paying actor gigs and stuff on film and on screen if you come into this little club format, where they then had a big group orgy things where they would fly kids to Hawaii and drug them and supposedly rape them. And then also they would do it in LA and all this kind of stuff. And it was all in terms of, you know, shut up and we'll give you gigs and then you'll be famous or what have you. It's a really interesting article. I do recommend that you read it. However, this seems just a skosh far-fetched.
It was just released also that Bryan Singer, it's reported that he was never in Hawaii during those specific times.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He's absolutely accused. I mean, I the guy who's leading this, Egan's Lawyers, again, led by Jeff Herman. This Jeff Herman guy is, I believe, just out to make a name for himself. And the sad part is that he is really trying to take on, almost in a class action format, all these people in Hollywood, Bryan Singer and all these other people who are named in this article. I just really think that it's kind of sad, because if any of those kids were hurt by anyone, not saying Bryan Singer in any way, shape, or form, but if any of these kids were hurt by anyone, it's just when you go out for these outrageous claims and you just go after everybody and you're throwing everything in the book. I mean, come on. I mean, seriously. Battery, assault, intentional infliction of emotional distress, invasion of privacy, unreasonable intrusion. I mean, you're literally throwing the book. And what happens is people just get so overwhelmed by this. As soon as one or two people start turning up not guilty, everybody gets not guilty. And if there is someone in there in this who's named in these suits that was hurting kids during this time, you're just killing yourself by throwing the book at people like Bryan Singer. I just, it's kind of sad to see this happen, because, again, going back to the Woody Allen thing, these people's lives are never going to be the same. And while it certainly seems in this case that it's just completely over the top and has no merit and is totally baseless, thankfully, it just sucks, because I'm just worried that there are, that people who might have done wrong will get swept under the rug and we might miss a couple bad people. I don't know. Where do you land on this, sir?
Show me the facts. It's like the Woody Allen Blue Jasmine situation. It's interesting that this is coming out now, right when all the hype with X-Men Days of Future Past is going on. It's a little nutty. It's a little kooky. I really don't know what to think. I mean, apparently this guy did file a lawsuit back in 2000. I think that's like a year or two after all this apparently went down. However, he didn't name Bryan Singer exactly, so nothing really came out of it. But he waited 15 years later, after Bryan Singer came out with another X-Men movie and a couple other movies and didn't say anything. So it's just a little weird. I mean, I don't know if anything happened or not. I mean, it's always a possibility. You know, I'm not going to say one thing happened over another thing, because I don't know. It's just a little fishy. And like you said, the guy is out. It sounds like he's out to make a name for himself. I saw a headline, I don't know if it was, I guess a day or two ago, saying that the lawyer got thrown out of court or something.
I did not hear that. I have not seen that one.
Yeah, because of like crazy accusations. I didn't read the entire article. I just kind of saw it in passing real quick and never didn't have a chance to go back and look at it. So, just a little weird.
I totally agree. I'm with you on this one. I really think this is a little bit too outlandish. And again, the problem that I have is that it's just really sad, because when you go after people like this and so out loud and so in your face, especially during times of big publicity like Days of Future Past and what have you, if there are real perpetrators, it just kind of gets drowned out. And that's really the ultimate sadness, I think. But at any rate, what do you got for us, sir?
This is from a Cinema Blend article entitled "Personal Electronics May Have a Bright, Unwelcome Future in Cinemas." A collective gasp. Ah! Or that's more of a scream.
Boo.
Gasp.
Boo. Yeah.
And this is written by Mike Rice. Mark?
Mike? Nick?
Mike Rice. R-E-Y-E-S. This came out April 7th of this year. And this is what it says. There are two types of moviegoers. Those who sit and watch the movie quietly. And those who can't go 5 minutes without being bathed in the glow of their personal electronic devices. The conflict between these two aspects of film watchers was an unintentional bullet point at the Society of Motion Picture and Television Engineers, or the SMPTE for short, recent Technology Summit on Cinema presentation. Buried in the midst of items about advanced post-production making home viewing preferable to going out for a movie, or suggesting that frame rates could vary from scene to scene in future productions, Variety captured a poll quote that even some of the industry's movers and shakers found to be a disturbing prospect. What was so disturbing about it? It suggested that eventually, not possibly, personal electronic devices will become commonplace in a darkened theater near you. According to Steve Weinstein, Chief Technology Officer at Deluxe Entertainment Services, theater owners might soon be giving into the ever-mounting pressure to let patrons use their cell phones or tablets. Why? Because according to Weinstein, the second screen in theaters, it's just an inevitability. That's one of those words I cannot say. Matt, can you translate?
If you're trying to say innovation?
No, it's inevitable.
Oh, inevitable. Yeah, there you go.
It's just an inevitability.
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 Thank you.
Sure.
How did the audience react to such a suggestion? God damn it. How did the audience react to such a suggestion?
Suggestion.
Variety noted... Yes. Variety noted that cell phone-friendly policies were seen as, and I quote again, a notion that brought groans from some who complained of seeing cell phone and tablet screens light up around them as they try to watch a film. In all quotes. The article goes on to say that the negative reaction isn't a surprise, and they ask the reader to imagine going into a screening of the upcoming horror film Oculus, and you're in a dark room, and it's apparently a very atmospheric movie, and it depends on your mood and the setting, and you're paying attention to the movie, so the movie can have the full impact. And if a tablet, which is huge, which is basically a freaking spotlight compared to a cell phone, goes off, you know, starts shining, it'll completely take you out of that moment. It's annoying. I mean, a lot of people in movie theaters can ignore that type of thing, but I cannot ignore something so blatant as that. I mean, I get annoyed with people chomping on popcorn, sitting within 10 feet away from me. I don't like this. I don't like this idea whatsoever. I mean, unless they end up having separate showings, separate times for these people, I can't go to the movies anymore. The Alamo Drafthouse will not allow this stuff. I know that for a fact. But there's hardly any Alamo Drafthouses around here. I mean, there are maybe a couple, you know, places like that in LA. But I think the showtime, I mean, it's just, I don't know, it's going to become a pain in the ass, I think. And I'm not even down with having a section of the theater being devoted to that audience. Because they're still going to react to it. There's still a possibility of it creating a vocal reaction. And most of the time, are the people even going to be using their iPads, tablets, or their phones to actually be using the second screen enhancement? No, they're probably going to be on their goddamn phone, Facebooking or texting somebody because they don't know how to watch a movie with a slower pace. So, that shit just ignores me. And yes, I did say ignores me. A cross between ignore and annoy.
Dude, I am totally with you on this one. I could see them actually trying to split it off and saying, I could see certain theater chains attempting it just as a test or whatever. But honestly, there's just way more people who spend anywhere from $9 to $20, depending on where you live, to go see a movie at night, and they're not going to want to sit there and waste $9 to $20, again, depending on where you live, to watch other people play on their fucking iPads, play on their phones, even if it was quote-unquote, you know, second-screen integration.
Yeah, I'd rather sit at home and watch a movie.
Exactly.
Sometimes. And just deal with the fucking bitch upstairs stomping around.
Absolutely. There are people, just way more people who will not pay that money than people that would. And, you know, people are going to speak with their dollars. I could see people doing tests with this. I could see chains happening. More than likely, those tests would occur during the day when attendance is lower. But there's no way they're going to chance that stuff for... here, let's say Captain America, right? I went to the premiere showing of Captain America. It was 3D. It was an IMAX. It cost me personally $15. I would not pay that money if I knew other people were going to be on their phones during that time period. There's absolutely no way. And I think that most of the theater chains understand that. I do understand that there is a inevitability crowd who thinks that second screen integration is just the wave of the future. And for the most part, I agree that there is a time and a place for that integration. But no way should it interfere with a true movie-going experience. I think that's what Blu-rays are for. You've got online content. You've got DVR stuff. You've got the Hopper nowadays. They're Dish. You have cable companies. All that stuff can be integrated at people's leisure without having to actually interfere with a true movie-going experience. So I am with you, sir, 100%. This is just a bad idea.
Bam!
Yeah. All right, so I'm going to wrap up the news here. I've got a really quick one here for you from the dailymail.co.uk, courtesy of Mail on Sunday Diary. The Mail on Sunday Diary says, from Thrones to Rome, hail Sean, the new Caesar. He's made a career out of playing ruthless men who show their rivals no mercy. So Game of Thrones star Sean Bean should be perfect as Julius Caesar in a new British film adaptation of Shakespeare's play. Now, the thing is here is that I just thought it was absolutely hilarious that this article comes out. Homeboy doesn't fucking live in anything. He dies in everything. He just dies. If you see him on screen, he's gonna fucking die. And what's he getting? He's getting the title role in Julius Caesar. Guess who's gonna fucking die? Sean Bean is gonna die. And that's my news. I don't know if you have anything to add to that, but that's my news.
That's pretty funny. Unless they don't show him dying at the end.
Well, thankfully, I guess, in this particular instance, he gets to die in the middle. So I suppose that's something. All right, folks. So then I guess that ends the news and brings us to our next segment, which, of course, as we told you last week, was...
Masterpiece Discussion, also known as Discussions with Matt and Tim. This week on Discussions with Matt and Tim, we discuss the CinemaBlend.com article, Cinemax Goes to War with Actress Who Refused to Show Her Nipples, courtesy of Mac Rodden. And now, Discussions with Matt and Tim.
All right, so good times here. We have... the case in question centers around an episode of Cinemax's Femme Fatales and an actress named Anne Lee Green. She was in one of the Saw movies and, more importantly, appeared in a 2012 episode of this particular show entitled Jailbreak. Again, Femme Fatales, not the actual TV series Jailbreak, but an episode of the Femme Fatales series called Jailbreak. At the time of its airing, neither her performance nor the subject matter drew much reaction. But all that changed when she filed a lawsuit claiming she was sexually harassed and bullied into taking clothes off and having simulated sex on camera. For various reasons, the defendants, Time Warner, HBO, Cinemax, and True Crime LLC, refrained from commenting at length in public when she first hired a lawyer. But this past week, which was this week before last, because the story broke on the 9th of April, True Crime's own attorneys finally responded with a countersuit. It basically reads like a middle finger that takes Green to task and paints her as a difficult, manipulative woman who cost the producers thousands of dollars and failed to honor the industry standard of bringing up any problems with nudity prior to the beginning of production. In short, it's a he said, she said mess, but considering the potential ramifications, it's worth it to outline exactly what each is saying. All right. The idea behind the article is HBO/Cinemax, whatever, they put down in front of this lady a nudity clause. You are going to be nude in this show. The defendant, Ann Lee Green, says that's not the case, that it was left very ambiguous as to whether or not there was going to be any nudity. And so when it came time to film, she said, I don't want to show anything more than I have to. Now, when you get into that position, it does halt production because they're like, look, we're supposed to have some nudity here. And she's like, I'm not showing anything. So what do you do? Do you halt production and then go find body doubles, stop everything to hire people who are going to do it, drop her, refilm everything? Or do you just kind of just roll with the punches? To me, this kind of harkens back to the whole Kim Basinger thing back in the early 90s when there was a verbal contract in place and she was actually held to the standard of a verbal contract. I gotta say, when you walk in, for me, when you walk into a show from Skinamax, mind you, that plays late at night, that is called Femme Fatales, and the episode's called Jailbreak, you gotta be expecting that you're gonna be taking your clothes off. And if you're not expecting that, then what the hell are you doing in Hollywood? I mean, I don't want to seem like an asshole here or sexist or anything, but I mean, look, you know what you're walking into. That's what these shows are about. That's why it's airing on Skinamax. And yes, I'm calling it Skinamax instead of Cinemax, because let's face it, any guy from the age of puberty on knows that the late night shit on Cinemax is where you go to get the really good softcore porn shit. I mean, as much fun as you want to have with Game of Thrones, there's really not all that much quote-unquote active sex happening. Yes, there's lots of nudity, but there's not quote-unquote sex actively happening. In Skinamax shows like Femme Fatales, that's what they're for. I mean, I remember when I was growing up, it was Zalman King's Red Shoe Diaries. And if there was an episode without nudity or a sex scene, I don't remember it. I don't think it happened. I gotta side with HBO on this one.
I thought Zalma Kings was on Showtime.
True. That is true. That was on Showtime. But I digress. I think that when you know you're on these channels and it's late at night, with HBO proper, it's usually like the real sex shows or what have you, you know what you're getting into. And to sit there and wait till the actual day of production to speak up about it is not cool. I've got to side with her. I mean, it'd be one thing if she just absolutely never had heard of anything, if she was from another country and didn't understand that's how things worked, and then perhaps there might have been ambiguous language. But you know what you're getting into at this point. You know what the format of the show is. You know what the shows are about. You know the time that it's going to be airing. You know what you're getting into. And I personally, there's just no way for me that she can claim that she didn't know what she was supposed to do. Now, I'm not trying to say that she doesn't have a right to her modesty. Absolutely. But not when you're going on to a Cinemax show called Femme Fatales. So that's where I land on it. I don't know. What do you think, Tim? Do you agree, disagree? Am I way off base, or are we agreed here?
I don't know. I mean, this could go either way, because obviously she knew what she was getting herself into. But kind of like what it says here in the article, it says that regardless, when she showed up to the set for the first of several days, nothing went according to plan. Her attorney told The Hollywood Reporter scenes were rewritten on the fly, the set wasn't properly closed down, and she was forced to disrobe under threat of a lawsuit. End quote. If you are uncomfortable with doing it when you were supposed to do it, Not because of what you believe in, like you completely change your mind because, oh, you know what, I said I want to do it, but I don't anymore. But if her reasons were because things were just suddenly changed, like the script or whatnot, and the set wasn't closed down. And for all of you that don't understand what it means by the set wasn't a closed set or it wasn't closed down, it means that normally with a movie, and I just worked on an AFI movie where there was a sex scene, a few sex scenes, and only the key people were supposed to be on set. That means the director, the producer, the camera operator, a main lighting person, hair and makeup, and wardrobe. But depending on what kind of sex scene it is, more than likely there's not going to be much wardrobe. It may be one or two people, give or take, you know, who knows, depending on what you're doing. And that's it. And they're supposed to, those people are supposed to get to know the actress. The actress is supposed to feel very comfortable in front of them, be comfortable with them. There are even times, movies and shows where people, women would have to get undressed. And she had the entire crew get undressed as well. I wish I could remember what movie that was, but I remember hearing that and thinking it was pretty funny. And hoping that I would never have to be put in that situation personally. But if the set isn't closed off, then anybody can walk in. And that can be very uncomfortable. That atmosphere of being, of that safe feeling, of that trusting feeling, it's kind of broken. And on top of that, things were written on the fly, scenes were changed, dialogue was changed. You know, things were kind of getting thrown at her, new stuff was getting thrown at her, alternate stuff was getting thrown at her. So, I mean, I'm sure that produced a very uncomfortable and not at all what she expected kind of type of atmosphere. And there are some actors and actresses that can easily get over that and deal with it, but then there are some who are still a little bit modest despite what they're working on and really need that sense of comfort. So that's what I'm saying. I mean, I don't know how much of that is true and how much of that is not true. I definitely see where you're coming from. If you signed a contract, you signed a contract. But then again, if the producers and the set isn't held to the contract as well, they're not putting up their part of the bargain. And most of that stuff is pretty much an unwritten rule. I mean, you're supposed to, I don't really know how much of that is in a contract for this sort of thing or not, but you're supposed to have a closed set and they're supposed to provide a sense of comfort. So the scene is done right and, you know, under the right
circumstances.
Yeah, circumstances. You know, that's kind of where I stand at that.
Well, fair enough. I really think that there's one key sentence in this article that I think we should definitely close this out on. Because I think that we have both made very reasoned arguments here, and I can't disagree with yours, and you've already stated can't kind of disagree with mine, but there's definitely an unknown here, and neither one of us know exactly to the extent of what the unknown is. And I think it wraps it up very, very succinctly to say that since none of us were on set at the time, it's impossible for us to know exactly what happened.
But however, there's one thing before we end the article, is that depending on how this works out, like what happens with this, if it goes to court and, you know, whatever the ruling comes down, this can affect a lot of contracts and a lot of movies, because depending on what happens, an actress or an actor can say, okay, I'll do a nude shot or whatever. And when it comes down to it, then they'll be able to, you know, depending on what the ruling is, they can say, oh, you know what? No, I don't want to anymore. You know, just do it from the chest up, or just do it from the neck up or shoulders up, or I want a body double, or I want to do the CGI thing, do whatever. But, you know, so this could be a potential issue.
I agree there, but I really think that that the only people who will win ultimately in this, regardless of who comes out on top, will be the lawyers. Because all this is going to happen is that an extra $100,000 is going to be spent on lawyers' fees on both sides. Let's just split it down the middle, $50,000 apiece between the actor and the studio in determining actual contract language. Because they will then make sure that there is no ambiguous language going forward if it is ruled that there was ambiguous language. So that they will be able to hold all actors and actresses accountable for what they sign when they sign any kind of nudity rider. So I think this is really just going to boil down to one more for the lawyers. But it'll be interesting, so we'll definitely have to keep a track on it. What do you think? Yes, keep track of it?
Yeah, definitely.
Outstanding. All right, well then I guess thus concludes...
Discussions with Matt and Tim. Next week for our bonus segment, in lieu of Discussions with Matt and Tim, we will be having a fun episode of, or segment of, I'm the Only One Who Liked It. I think we all know which one Matt is going to come up with, but perhaps we do not know yet what Tim will come up with. And so that will be the fun of next week's segment of I'm the Only One Who Liked It. Thank you again for listening to Discussions with Matt and Tim, also known as Masterpiece Discussion.
Yay! Okay, so last but not least is our regularly scheduled segment of The Movies!
You know, if I had to say that, it would have come out as... Now it's time for our regularly scheduled segment.
I'm doing pretty good, considering the amount of alcohol I've drank.
You are. I think there's like a weird, like, escape from which mountain thing happening between the two of us.
Outstanding. I would prefer to go with Corsican Brothers than Escape from Witch Mountain, but I'm fine with that as well. This week's movies, we're going to be the Dollars Trilogy, also known as the Man with No Name Trilogy, brought to us by Sergio Leone, who single-handedly resurrected the Western genre, as we know. And while people, depending on the people involved, will either affectionately or not affectionately refer to these as the spaghetti westerns, they still did the unthinkable at the time, which was completely resurrect the western as a genre. It showed that it was still completely viable. The trilogy is unrelated. Think of it as Edgar Wright's trilogy. But they still maintain similar actors and or similar characters, even if the characters do not have the same name throughout each step of the trilogy. First one was 1964's Fistful of Dollars. Second one was 1965's For a Few Dollars More. And finally, the third one was, of course, the eponymous The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly from 1966. We will just go ahead and do these in order. So we're going to start with Fistful of Dollars. And this, of course, is about a stranger, the, you know, man with no name, who arrives at a Mexican border town of San Miguel, where he is able to, much like certain Shakespearean plays, was able to play one rival gang against the other to his benefit, while at the same time kind of bringing a brand of justice to a town that desperately needed it.
I think it's a fantastic movie. What I really like about it is the backstory behind it. Sergio Leone, like you said, he wanted to reinvent the Western genre because he loves Westerns. The old Westerns. The problem with the Westerns during the 60s is that Hollywood was, you know, kind of shooing them away, because a lot of them were becoming repetitive, boring, laughably bad, with cheesy, hammy dialogue. There was just absolutely nothing new. I mean, at the time, you have the 60s golden age of cinema happening, which we pretty much talked about last week with Head. You have bukus of war movies coming out. Even at this time, musicals were going out of style as well. So he wanted to do something different. So he didn't get funding at all from America, the U.S. This proved to be a Italian, Spanish, and German joint movie. That is why you have Spanish-speaking, Italian-speaking, and German-speaking actors in this movie. And what's interesting is you'll notice the dubbing. They all spoke in their foreign, in their homeland dialect. That's why you see some people pronouncing something or their mouths are moving completely different from other people, and that's because that with Italian cinema, they it is known that they don't use a mic at all. They go and dub in post-production. That's why even with, we'll talk about The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, that movie has horrible dubbing. I mean, it's a feat how the movie is still fantastic and that the dubbing really isn't that much of a distraction, though I'm sure it is for a lot of people. And another reason why is because not only Italians and Sergio Leone, but a lot of those guys really wanted to focus on the action and their visionary style other than acting itself. Even though Sergio Leone really does kind of, or has in many interviews, put Clint Eastwood down, saying that he is an actor, or he is a star that knows how to act with the hat on and act with the hat off. I don't know if that's the exact quote or not, but it's something like that. But it's really funny. And this was actually Clint Eastwood's breakout movie. I mean, one of his first things he ever did was Rawhide, where he played a cowboy, and he really wanted to break away and do a anti-hero. And this is actually one of the classic and most famous of the anti-heroes, is The Man with No Name. These movies were not intended to be trilogies. It actually happened after the A Fistful of Dollars came out. United Artists became the international, or released it internationally to the U.S. And for marketing, to get more people interested in the movie, they coined the phrase, or they actually started calling, referencing Clint Eastwood's character as the Man with No Name. So that, you know, people, once they started seeing Clint Eastwood in a Sergio Leone movie, they put two and three together and thought, oh, well, this has got to be a trilogy. And it also doesn't help that the costumes are the same. His costumes are the same, as well as he's smoking the same cigar. He's basically a bounty hunter in every single one of the movies. But that's okay. It's cool. It's awesome. It works perfectly. Two more things before I get to what I actually think about the movie, because this also goes with the backstory of it as well, which are really important. Clint Eastwood was not the first choice to be the Man with No Name. It originally went to, like, James Coburn, Henry Fonda. Henry Fonda turned it down. Or actually, no, they couldn't even get Henry Fonda to even turn it down because they couldn't afford him. Because they didn't have enough money, because they were just, you know, it was a Spanish, Italian, German movie. They asked Charles Bronson to be in the movie. He turned it down, saying that he thought the script was bad. He didn't like the script at all. However, Charles Bronson did recommend this one actor, and his name is Clint Eastwood. And Charles Bronson is actually quoted in an interview saying something along the lines of, the next best thing that I could have done after turning down A Fistful of Dollars was suggesting Clint Eastwood to play the main character, which I thought was very interesting. A Fistful of Dollars is also the remake, the unauthorized remake of Akira Kurosawa's Yojimbo, which has also been influenced by a Dashiell Hammett novel. The thing with these remakes of movies is that you have to own the rights to the original movie in order to do a remake. And Sergio Leone didn't own the rights to the remake, but yet he went ahead and made the movie anyway. And it was during a screening when Akira Kurosawa saw the movie, he wrote to Sergio Leone and the producers or the whatever, and he said something along the lines of, "It was a fine film, but it was my film." And those 2 years that followed the release of the movie in Spain was a 2-year lawsuit. And that is why the movie was not released for over two years in the United States. And that is another reason why all three of these movies were released back to back to back. I think just within a handful of months after each other. So, like, you know, every 4 months a new Man with No Name movie came out. Which also, the marketing helped that out a whole lot, because it became like an event. The movies made so much money. And this first one is fantastic. It is a good remake. Even though it is an unauthorized remake, it is still fantastic. Now, A Fistful of Dollars is a fantastic movie, as I said. It is tongue-in-cheek with, or it has some great tongue-in-cheek humor. Clint Eastwood is... he just commands the freaking movie. The villains are great. For those who don't know what the story is about, it's pretty much a man who pits two rival gangs in this small Mexican border town against each other. And he's... I don't know what to really call him. He basically makes both of the gangs think that he is working for them. And at the same time, he's pitting them against the two of them. And hopefully that... In doing so, he can run the both of them out of town to save all the townsfolk and all that stuff. Again, he is an anti-hero. This establishes his character as an anti-hero. He is driven by money, by greed, mainly just money. He wants to get paid. And he is driven by, I think, his own sick humor. This movie has a classic line when he's on his way to talk to one of the gang members, one of the cowboys, and he walks past the coffin maker, and he says, you ought to have three coffins ready. And he goes and he encounters the cowboys, and that encounter leads to him shooting four cowboys. And as he turns to walk away, he stops by the coffin maker again and says, sorry, I was mistaken. Make that four. And he just walks off. The whole entire time, he's chewing and sucking on this cigar, this leathery-looking cigar, and yet it never decomposes, it never falls apart, it never gets very soggy, which even adds to the manliness and the badassness that is Clint Eastwood as the man with no name. Fantastic movie. The cinematography is beautiful. The music is great. I can't really think of anything I can say against this movie. It holds up today wonderfully. I recommend it. 5 stars for me.
There's really not a whole lot that I can say to add to this. Cinematography is great. The writing is great. And there will be... I get the feeling that people who have never seen this before will be slightly confused by the dialogue. And this isn't... And while I want to say it doesn't have anything to do with the way that the script is written out or anything, it does, however, have to do with, as Tim pointed out, the way that the film was made. In Italian cinema, you filmed on set, and then you went back and re-recorded your dialogue, so it was then dubbed in. Don't let that take anything away from it. Just experience the movie as it unfolds. It's fantastic. The cinematography is great. The pacing is amazing. I will, however, say that it wasn't Charles Bronson. It was Richard Harrison who recommended Eastwood. The only other thing I can add is that Eastwood was the guy who pretty much built The Man with No Name from the ground up. He got the black jeans himself. He picked out the hat. He actually, as a non-smoker, even still came up with the idea for the cigars himself. I think that just kind of sums it up. And when you watch this movie, bear that in mind. It makes the movie 100 times better. Knowing that going in, it makes the movie 100 times better. Because Eastwood was a non-smoker, but he's the one who went out of his way to get those cigars. And just like Tim pointed out, the cigars add so much to it. It's really good. So... definitely agree here. 5 out of 5. Fantastic movie. Holds up well. It's aged fantastically. This is definitely one of the reasons why cinema westerns were reinvigorated by this and why Clint Eastwood is where he is today. I guess moving forward, 1965's For a Few Dollars More. This one, again, stars The Man with No Name. Now, it's, again, you have to understand that given that this is kind of in the style of Edgar Wright's trilogy, where it's not about continuity, it's about characters, it's about the visualization, it's about the style of the filmmaking and the genres with which they take place, that he technically has no name, though in this one they do refer to him as Manco, which is a kind of like a Spanish slang term of one-armed, which is given by the fact that Clint Eastwood basically gets to be a badass with just one arm. He's got his one arm, his left arm, that he uses for everything, beating people up, just proving exactly how amazing he is and all that wonderful stuff. And then his right arm, which is pretty much just used for shooting. With which he is, of course, still equally deadly. Now, one of the things that I think is great about this film is that not only does it bring back the bad guy in this, Gian Maria Volante plays El Indio, or the Indian. He was the bad guy in A Fistful of Dollars. So they were able to resurrect him, bring him back. They also introduce a new character, Lee Van Cleef, who is Colonel Douglas Mortimer. Now, what's great about this is that they're able to bridge these movies with such iconic characters. El Indio is one of the most vicious villains ever in the history of villains. He is the perfect archetype of what a villain should be. That's what makes this movie so amazing. Honestly, almost as much as Clint Eastwood's anti-hero, but still the hero, of Manco. And then, of course, you introduce a new character in Lee Van Cleef as Colonel Douglas Mortimer, and then you have just this awesome triumvirate of people working together, more like anti-heroes working together against one of the most vicious villains that you could ever possibly think of. And remember, this is 1965. This was seriously pushing the bounds of cinema, especially in the United States at that time. You still had people who were all about morals and people you didn't curse and look at television at that time. But yet at the same time, look at where real world politics were heading during then. Look at what was actually happening in the national scope and how the public was changing and wanting something that was more sophisticated. Inadvertently, I want to say, because this was more of a world view in the way that the film was made, it fed into that. And I gotta say, I was, kind of a spoiler alert, I was really kind of disappointed that Gian Maria Volante was not in the third movie, was not in The Good, the Bad, the Ugly. I was so looking forward to him as an established bad guy, because it's been a while for me since I've seen these movies, so I didn't have everything remembered, that I was really kind of disappointed when we got there, because he plays such an amazing villain for these two movies. But you still get this wonderful introduction to Colonel Douglas Mortimer that's played by Lee Van Cleef. The dialogue is great. The character development is so subtle that while they're both basically just bounty hunters, carrying on, Clint Eastwood kind of carrying on his mantra from throughout the trilogy, really, they still shift. Neither one of them are what people might refer to as dynamic characters, but there is still a subtle shift in all three, and you just see this so perfectly played out again. And then of course you have the pacing from the original movie that translates into this. What a wonderful story, great writing, which translates so well. And then, of course, amazing cinematography, wonderful music. The choral backing to this is just absolutely outstanding. And it just brings it all together in probably one of the best showdowns ever, with a both solid ending and yet somewhat ambiguous ending that you're still going to smile at. So for me, just like the first movie, 5 stars. 5 out of 5 here as well. Tim, what do you got for us, sir?
This is my favorite movie out of all of them. I mean, this is a movie where I can see where Quentin Tarantino would have gotten some of his style from, because the movie takes its time, which is nice. It doesn't have a ton of settings, which is great. And I like how the movie is split up into stages. The entire movie is not about two bounty hunters working together to find this criminal and all this stuff. No, you have to establish that these two guys are bounty hunters, that they are looking for somebody for some reason. One of them you kind of already know why, which is the man who, Clint Eastwood, you know why he's looking for him. He just wants the money. You know, it goes back to the Groot thing that I was talking about. But with Mortimer, you just think he's a badass bounty hunter. And to me, he is my favorite, or at least one of my favorite movie bounty hunters ever. He's just fantastic. I definitely know of Lee Van Cleef, but I really want to go back and watch Sabata and the sequel that he was in. That I haven't seen that in a while, so I really want to go back and watch those. Too bad those are on Netflix. But I digress. This is good. A little bit of backstory with this one. So the first movie was a huge success over in Spain, in Italy. It was a huge, 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 huge success. And Eastwood would not commit to do another film. Because at that time, you know, like I said, it wasn't for another 2 years that the first movie was going to be released. So by this time, nobody has seen the movie in America. So Clint Eastwood would not commit to a movie until he has seen it. Until he saw the first one. So Sergio Leone rushed him a copy of the movie. It wasn't dubbed in English because it didn't exist at the time. So he watched it with a few of his friends, and apparently that he downplayed the movie so much because he thought it was going to suck. And he got his friends together and watched it at CBS Studios, and he was blown away by it. It turned out to be opera on the screen. You know, it pushed the boundaries of not only movies but an entire but genres, various genres. So he decides to do it. To get the Mortimer role, they then went back to Charles Bronson. But Charles Bronson passed on that role as well, and he felt that the movie was just as bad as the first script. Which is pretty funny. So therefore they got Lee Van Cleef. The fantastic Lee Van Cleef. The script was written in only 9 days, which is an amazing feat. And the movie turned out to be what it turned out. I mean, it was only shot in like 2 months, which is fascinating. Like Matt was saying, El Indio, which translates into the Indian in Spanish, is a fantastic bad guy. I just love the idea that he is haunted by memories of his past. I'm not going to tell you what, but, well, I guess I can. He raped a girl, and he's just haunted by it. Yet he sits down and he sits and he smokes. It's either marijuana or opium. He sits and he smokes to rid his mind of that pain and that awful thought. And to me, that creates a well-rounded bad guy, because you don't have many bad guys like that. Too many people are trying to be like Alan Rickman from Die Hard, where he was just a solid bad guy, and it fit, I guess, for that type of movie. But then you look at all the other Die Hard movies where every other bad guy fucking sucks, because they're all trying to be that bad guy who's trying to take over the world, who's trying to do this, trying to blow up this, trying to get all this. There's no backstory. You don't give a crap about these guys to where when the ending climactic scene happens or moment happens, there's no build up there. You don't give a shit whether if he lives or he dies. But this movie does everything right. You know, it shows how Mortimer and Clint Eastwood and the Man with No Name, how they get together, Manco, how the two of them get together. What makes them? Because you don't know if they're going to be rivals. You know, you don't know if they're going to like each other, if they're going to hate each other. And so it's nice to see everything play out the way it plays out. And it all leads to a beautiful, wonderful ending. Great music, beautiful score. You know, they had to build an entire... The city of El Paso. The sets were huge. So they had some grand... Well, nothing compared to the third movie. But it was a beautiful movie to look at. So this one, again, 5 stars for me. I highly recommend it. Again, it is absolutely my favorite movie. It is absolutely perfect. Everybody, you have to see. If not all these movies, you have to watch this one. So, there you go.
Right on. Okay, and I've got to agree with Tim, absolutely. For a few dollars more, my favorite movie of the trilogy, hands down. But the trilogy itself, just like Tim said, again, totally worth watching for all three. So please don't stop. Check them all out. So that brings us to the last, but certainly not the least. Although if you're me, it is the least. So maybe last and least, I don't know. The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. This is 1966. Then the closing of the Dollars trilogy, or the Man with No Name trilogy, stars Clint Eastwood, Lee Van Cleef, and again bringing Lee Van Cleef back in, but now brings us gives us a new guy by the name of Eli Wallach, or Wallach, depending on how you want to read that. This takes place during the end of the Civil War and is about three different men who converge for very different reasons upon a hunt for $200,000 in gold buried somewhere. Now, this movie, honestly, for me, is simply too long. I understand that this is the last of the trilogy. I understand what Sergio Leone was really trying to do here and was really just trying to go so much in grandiose ability, so much in scope, and really try and flesh out characters and tell an epic story that could then close out this trilogy, so to speak. Unfortunately, he just simply goes overboard. There is just way too much going on here, and it takes so long before all the stories converge to become a coherent tale that relates to everyone involved. And again, I understand what he was trying to do by bringing the individual characters into line so that you could see how these threads would come together. So many seemingly disparate threads coming together into one tale. I applaud the effort, but again, it just takes too long. Now, the version on Netflix doesn't help with this because it's the extended English language version. So it comes in at damn near 3 hours long. And It more or less exacerbates the problem. Even still, this is a great movie. And while it is definitely the most violent of the three, it's also one of the few films of the era that didn't bother me so much with the night lens issue. I have a thing, and I understand it was the technological availability at the time, but movies in this era, and actually even through most of the 70s, had this terrible night lens filter issue where they're trying to make it look like it's in the evening or it's at nighttime when it's blatantly during the day, but they just put a lens on it so that it looks like it's a shading lens so that it looks like it's nighttime. The other thing that I have with movies of this era was the blood literally looks like paint. It just looks like red paint. This movie took great pains to take care of that issue. And I want to point that out because that is definitely a plus to this movie. Unfortunately, the length of time that it takes to do everything, especially when it gets to the closing of the story, even as it comes to the closing of the story, you see that these characters are dead set in their ways, which is fine because these are the characters that they've established. No one's going to change everything. And it's so great to see, especially for Lee Van Cleef, who has switched roles. He's the bad in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. But he plays it so well and so smoothly that you can still appreciate the nuances of these characters. But unfortunately, even though everyone is completely set in their ways, you already know how things are going to turn out based on the labeling, and they do make very clear labeling early enough in the movie, that it still, everything takes too long to play out. And then, of course, by the time you get to the penultimate scene, where everybody's finally facing one another, they just take way too long. And I understand, building tension. It's literally trying to make you itching with anticipation. What's going to happen? Oh my God, get to it already. But there's that fine line. And again, I understand this is the English language extended version that you're going to see on Netflix if you haven't seen it already or if you don't already have your choice of DVD/Blu-ray. But it's just everything from the beginning, from bringing the threads together, takes too long. And while I really want to, you know, give the trilogy all 5 out of 5, I just simply can't. The writing is a little bit more crude, which was understandable given that the subject matter, but it just didn't flow as well as it could have. The pacing hurt because of the length, and again, everything just seems to take too long. However, still an iconic movie, and if nothing else, you're going to get the whole do-do-do-do-do-do-do out of it, and you get that in spades. It's fun. There's a lot of fun moments to be had. Clint Eastwood, I honestly think, while the second movie was the best and the first movie introduced it, I truly think Clint Eastwood had the most fun here. It's just a personal observation. I've got to give this one here 4 out of 5. Still a good movie, still a great movie. I really liked it, but it just, the length of it hurt it. The writing just wasn't as good, and everything seemed to take too long to come in. So I'm going to give it, but it's still a classic, and I'm going to give it 4 stars.
Yeah, like Matt, this is definitely the least favorite of the bunch, but it's still very entertaining and well-made. The original film, the original English release, was like 161 minutes. So if you can find that, definitely check that out. Because if you go to various websites and forums and talk to people who have seen the movie during that cut, it is worth seeing. It's preferred. I think a lot of some pretentious people who like to say, oh, the director's original version is the best version. That is not always the case. And I think that's the case here. I agree somewhat with Matt was saying that what his thoughts of Sergio Leone, what his intentions were with having these scenes kind of be long and drawn out more. And yeah, it was closing the movie, or closing the trilogy, I guess. However, Sergio Leone was in fact wanting to do another at one point in time. But by this time, Clint Eastwood would have nothing of it. He vowed to never work with Sergio Leone again. He even turned down a role for Once Upon a Time in the West, which ironically starred Charles Bronson and Henry Fonda, who were the two actors that turned down the role of the man with no name. And that was Leone's big Hollywood movie also. He loved the music score to it. And it is said, and I guess in his biographer, which I haven't read the book, but apparently this is what he says, is that a lot of people complained about the cuts of the movie. And this, I'm not quoting it or anything, but I'm just saying what I've read. He loved the music. He was so impressed with the score that he would often let the scene drag on just so there would be plenty of score. And he didn't believe, again, he's more of a visionary and not really, you know, acting. And so this movie kind of suffered a little bit because of the idea of, well, instead of cutting with the action, he cuts with the music. So, I don't know, and so that's kind of how it went. Because also, it is said that he had the music beforehand, and he would blast the music to get the characters in mood. So that could have been a case as well. So, but yeah, he was also a tyrant and ill-tempered that Clint Eastwood decided he never wanted to work with him again, and all that jazz. But, you know, was saying that, I'm there with Sergio Leone. I love the music, I love the score, it is fantastic. The blood and the effects look great, especially his sunburn. The character of Tuco was fantastic. He could be an asshole, a jerk, a two-faced son of a bitch, but there is a hint of sweetness and emotion with the guy, especially when he's looking back at his family and his past and all that stuff. It's pretty sad. This movie, it has some famous, well-known actors in it. Again, it goes on with everybody is playing from their ethnicity, their cultural background, except the actor of Tuco. He is from Brooklyn. He is actually that, if you've seen the movie The Holiday with Kate Winslet, he is that old writer guy that she ends up meeting here in Hollywood. That's that guy. He's been around forever. But it's still a good movie. I enjoyed it. I'm glad they didn't make another one. This is a good ending for it. I love it. Lee Van Cleef plays a brilliant villain. It was great to see him. I give this one 4.5 out of 5, even though really what only killed it was the lingering music and the lingering scenes and all the staring and pacing in front of each other. It was a little too much. But there was just so much more to like about this movie than to for me to take off any more than just half a star. So, 4.5 for me.
Right on. Well, then I guess that takes care of the movies. And next week, the movies are going to be Draft Day, Oculus, and A Fantastic Fear of Everything. Now, to be fair, you might be thinking to yourself, Draft Day? Isn't that a Kevin Costner film? And it is. But here's the thing. It's actually got a fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes. And given that it's got a fresh rating, I gotta go see what the hell people are thinking. And that's kind of why it made it on this list. So bear with us on that. All right, and given that, I think we're ready for the spiel, are we not, sir?
That is correct. Spiel on.
All right, well then, in that case, the music you've been listening to, as always, has been brought to us by our music partners, Cries of Solace. You can check them out at criesofsolace.com. Actually, fuck that. So the music you've been listening to, as always, has been brought to us by our music partners, Cries of Solace. You can check them out at myspace.com, reverbnation.com, and facebook.com/criesofsolace. We, of course, are the SLS cast. You can check us out at slscast.com. You can send an email to theslscast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter at theslscast. You can subscribe to us on iTunes. You can go to Facebook and search the SLS cast there and like us and all that good stuff as well. And then, of course, favorite us on Stitcher. And so, until next week, this is Matt saying that thanks to Doris Day, I get to say this. I've never met an animal I didn't like, and I can't say the same thing about people.
Take care, guys. Talk to you next week.
Thanks again for listening to the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim. Remember that you can find us at slscast.com, at the SLS Cast for Twitter, also on Facebook, and you can always subscribe on iTunes. Thanks again for listening.